Good. Okay, we're coming to 2 Samuel, and after this class, we're taking a little break. We're going to be Christmas break, go to Florida. We come back, and on the 6th of January, we pick it up with two horrendous assignments in a row. As I understand it, in the Through the Bible notebook, they've got you reading 1 Kings and 2 Kings in 1 week. Oh. And then they've got you reading 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles in 1 week. I would suggest that maybe over the Christmas break you want, if you're not too far behind already, you might want to read ahead a little bit, all right? If you're still in Leviticus, read as best you can and try to catch up. But these are major assignments. In 1 and 2 Kings, you've got the kingship of Solomon, and you've got the split of the kingdom. You got the prophet Elijah, and so forth. So that's forthcoming. Have I started this with a prayer yet? Have I done that yet? See if the brain can hang on till next summer's vacation. Let's begin with a prayer. Lord our God, we pray for all persons who are going through difficult times of turmoil and loss. We pray, Lord, for your blessing on all of the households of this world. We pray that we might be in touch with your spirit and your love. In Jesus' name, amen. It has been a difficult day for many. I would point out Harold Roland died this afternoon. He had been in a coma, and I think the right decision, he was brain dead. And he died this afternoon, and my glasses have broken. You may have heard on the news about a minister in Indianapolis, Indiana, with his wife who was murdered, good friends of Janice and of mine. We got that word this morning. So it's been a rough day for the home team. So we're going to try to function as best we can and get through this. But let's go into 2 Samuel. And in your notebook, the basics of the course are in highlight here, and then what I'm going to do is break it down a little bit more fine-tuning than they do and walk you through five sections and try to make sure that you've at least got the key stuff of this particular book so that when the test comes, you'll know what to say. Essentially, as they point out at the outset, the book of 2 Samuel is about David's kingship. It's about David, right? And pretty much start to finish. David is the lead character. Pivotal passage by way of outline is here in 2 Samuel 5, 4, and 5. I won't look it up here and read it, but it is essentially indicating that David reigned for the 40 years. He spent the first 7.5 as king at Hebron in Judah, and then the last 33 years he was the king in all of Israel. The Through the Bible people outlined the book by dividing it exactly in half. I'm going to fine-tune that, and you may want to make some notes right here as to what the structure of the book is. In my judgment, it is better to say that it starts out in chapters 1 through 4 with David as the king in Judah. And then in chapters 5 through 10, you have got really the glory days. These are the heyday. This is the big time stuff. 5 through 10, David is winning battles. David is improving the economy. When people think back to the kingship of David, they're thinking of chapters 5 through 10. probably it deserves a lot more ink than it gets. 2 Samuel is not unlike the news. You know, you've got phenomenal stuff going on, and they're going to spend a good bit of their time on some of the political intrigue and so forth. But this block of time from 5 to 10 is really the heyday of David. Then, as often happens in a frontier kind of justice, and I'll refer to it as such several times, you need to understand this is wide open frontier kinds of stuff. You don't have the kind of civilized society, even though there are evidences to the contrary, but you don't have the kind of civilized, orderly society that we have grown accustomed to here. And where you have got leaders in a patriarchal sort of a society where women are sort of objects to be used, you periodically find that the male leaders have sins of the flesh. And David is going to have one in 11 and 12. So that's a turning point where you've got a really the downfall of David as a result of that. You've then got in chapters 13 to 18 the intrigue with Absalom. 13 to 8. Then in 19 to 24, just various incidents. Most of the action of the book will come in the first half. And let's start with chapters 1 through 4. We've got new cups in the office that have very small bottoms. Did you notice this? I'm going to spill this stuff. Anybody listening on tape probably doesn't care. In fact, many who are here tonight don't care. But let's take chapters 1 through 4, and let me give you a couple things by way of overview. Number one, we have to repeat again and again that God is God. God works his purpose out. God is bringing about the divine purpose in the midst of absolutely absurd human behavior. And God has to bring about his purpose in the midst of absolutely bizarre human behavior, because that's about all there is. You see? And if God is going to be at work in this fallen world, trying to reclaim the fallen world, God's purpose is somehow happening through fallenness, and particularly in the intrigue of the first four chapters of 2 Samuel, you're probably reading along going, you know, I hadn't read the Bible before. I had always thought it was a book about holy people doing holy things, and I read this stuff and I don't believe it. You know? So I indicated in the first class that we had that one of the things you've got to deal with in reading the Bible is your own disillusionment. That this is the kind of thing, if on television, you would not want your kids to watch. All right? And it's Bible. So God works in a sinful world. The second point is that the kingship that was established, that we talked about last time, with Saul being the king, was very loosely put together with no plan of succession. Today, I think the Electoral College voted for the president. I think it happened today. We have a plan in our country as to how leaders are elected and take office. Even in Great Britain, there's an orderly succession so that you know who the next person on the cover of the National Enquirer is going to be in Buckingham Palace. And for all of the goings on there, we know who's next in line. When they establish a king who is Saul, we were somewhat unclear last week as to how they did that or why, and it's very unclear as to how he was going to be succeeded. You've got two philosophies at work. One is the whole notion that Saul has been named king in a charismatic sort of a way, that the Spirit came upon him. Obviously, the Spirit has come upon David. David will be the next king. On the other hand, you had the story of Saul becoming the king in a kind of a bureaucratic sense, and that other strand that was woven in there, and it would be assumed then that his son is going to become the king. As a consequence, at the death of Saul, you've got the charismatic successor and the lineage successor vying for power. You do not have an orderly succession as to who will follow, nor will you following the death of David, or even when it comes time to replace David, which happened prior to his death. Okay, so the political process is difficult. The third point is that the seeds of division are always there. We pointed out last time how difficult it is to take a confederacy and make a union of them. We used our own illustration here of the Civil War was essentially the battle between the Confederacy and the Union. And in the situation here, I'm not sure they ever put it together. You've got three kings of Israel, Saul, David, Solomon, three names to remember, like your Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. You've got Saul, David, and Solomon. At the end of each one's reign, there is something of a difficult transition and some squabbling among the different tribes. After Solomon's reign, the kingdom will split, never to be reunited. And the seeds of the split are found in 2 Samuel 1 through 4. You've got the kingdom of Israel, kind of an up and down kind of a geography. And at the bottom, if you look at your map, the tribe of Judah is the most southern of them. Bethlehem is in Judah, or Judea, as it would be called in the New Testament. Hebron is there. And then just at the northern edge of Judah, you've got Benjamin and Jerusalem just over the line. And the split seems to be between Judah and Israel. Israel being the other 11 tribes that weren't Judah. That schism was there through the reign of Saul, is there throughout the reign of David, and becomes real after the reign of Solomon. So you've got God working in a sinful world, you've got problems of succession, and you've got the seeds of division, and if you understand all of that, you're probably ready for the essay section of the test. Now, as you get into these first four chapters, David learns of Saul's death and grieves. Saul, though he was David's enemy, was nonetheless God's appointed and anointed leader. And David respected him, and David grieved at his death. One thing you learn early on is never take bad news to David. All right? In fact, don't even take what you think is good news to David if it involves having killed one of his enemies. Because people would come in, they would tell David, your enemy has been killed, and yes, I did it. You're going to wind up dead. David will slew you, or whatever. Then David has a lament. And you tell me what David is saying here. In 1:26, talking about Saul's son, Jonathan, the relationship to David we discussed briefly last week, and we'll discuss briefly this week. I grieve for you, my brother Jonathan, who's killed with Saul. How dear you were to me, how wonderful was your love for me, better than the love of women. As I said last week, I don't know what those campers were up to, but there are those who suspect that this was not just a couple guys having a beer watching a football game. That these guys, yes. So we move on to David being made king in Judah, and Saul, and some of the names here are absolutely absurd, Saul's son, Ishbosheth. It's really hard to get a good chant going, you know. We like Ishbosheth, you know, you just can't, you can't make it happen. Abner, who was a leader in Saul's military, goes into cahoots with Ishbosheth, who becomes the king of all the northern tribes. Joab and David become the leaders in Judah. There is then a face-off. They have what they might call a sit-down at a pool where 12 of the leaders of David's camp are on, or the leaders of David's camp on one side, leaders of Ishbosheth's camp on the other side. And they decide that the way to settle this once and for all as to who's going to become the king is that they're going to get 12 great fighters from Ishbosheth's team and 12 great fighters from David's team, and they're going to have at it, and whoever wins will be king. So all the guys are right-handed. All of them have their swords in their right hand. They all run at each other. They all go like this, and 24 guys drop dead with swords in them. A very brief fight, whoop, and then rioting breaks out. There's problems, and this just doesn't solve the thing whatsoever. You have in chapter 3, verse 1, the fighting between the forces supporting Saul's family and those supporting David went on for a long time. As David became stronger and stronger, his opponents became weaker and weaker. David will win a war of attrition. Ishbosheth gets a little paranoid. He accuses Abner of having sexual relations with one of Saul's concubines, which is not only sort of a grossing out of Saul's family, but also if one has sexual relations with the concubines or one of the many wives of a king, one is thought to have assumed the power and place of that king. So they're not only grossed out, they are fearful that Abner is trying to take over, maybe. And Abner says, I didn't do it. And so Abner gets mad at Ishbosheth and goes over to David's side. We have already had a bizarre incident of Joab's brother, who is chasing Abner, and it's kind of like a roadrunner situation where they're kind of running along in chapter 2. Abner says, stop chasing me. He says, no, I'm going to chase you. Stop chasing me or I'll have to kill you. And he runs his spear backwards as the guy's catching up to him and impales him on the spear and kills him. This makes Joab angry, and eventually Joab conspires, even though Abner has won David's confidence, and Joab kills Abner. All of this is the process by which a new king is going to be selected. And David grieved Abner, who was kind of a hero in the northern kingdoms, and the people kind of liked the fact that David did this. Ishbosheth is then asleep, and whoever the women were who were guarding him were drowsy, and so some people go in and kill Ishbosheth. And as a consequence of this, David, who is angry that the people killed Ishbosheth and has them killed, David becomes king. And God worked his purpose out through that story. That David, who had served for 7.5 years in Hebron, now becomes, after 7.5 years, the king of all of Israel through a very sordid and seamy process. You come to chapters 5 through 10, and the main thing I'd highlight for you here is that the people take over Jerusalem. Up to this point, Jerusalem has not been a Jewish city. It's been the city of the Jebusites, Jebus. And they have tunnels to get into Jerusalem, and one of them, I guess, perhaps extended or built sometime later even maybe, but one of them, our tour group, went through. I would not want to get stuck in this thing. This is a long, dark tunnel where you are walking through water and you're kind of down like this as you go, and being somewhat claustrophobic, I'm going to keep moving, you know, and then we finally got through it. David and the troops went through a tunnel into Jerusalem and conquered the people. Great things are happening here almost instantly, happening in the commerce field. In verse 9 of chapter 5, after capturing the fortress, David lived in it and named it David's City. Very creative. Then in number 11, 5:11, King Hiram of Tyrus sent a trade mission to David. He provided him with cedars, the cedars of Lebanon, carpenters and stonemasons to build a palace. So David realized that the Lord had established him as the king of Israel and was making his kingdom prosperous for the sake of his people. After, none of you do what all politicians have to do, of course, after moving from Hebron to Jerusalem, David took more concubines and wives. It pales in comparison to the work that Solomon would do. We'll come to that in a while. Had more sons and daughters by all kinds of women. And how or why somebody would make the distinction that these 50 are my concubines and these 20 are my wives, I don't understand. But anyway, he has lots of children. He is now establishing himself as a major world player. He is opening up international commerce. He is developing a new capital city that is going to be world class with outstanding buildings and facilities. He is conquering people in battle. Victory over the Philistines, as you see here. And now it's time to bring the covenant box to Jerusalem. Covenant box, remember, had that kind of wild history of Philistines had had it for a while, and they got tumors and their gods fell over. And as they are bringing the covenant box to Jerusalem, you remember that tragic story where the cart jostles a bit and a fella reaches up to steady it, and if you touch the covenant box, you drop dead. And this he did. And so they decide, let's not take the covenant box all the way into Jerusalem. Let's leave it out in the suburbs for a while until we figure out what to do. But the covenant box is on the way. Power, as best he can, is being centralized in Jerusalem, the new capital of a newly gathered, though loosely put together, government. And as you remember last week, Saul didn't do that kind of stuff. Saul didn't bureaucratize, didn't go with the concubines, didn't build big buildings. He kind of ran the thing out of the back of an Esso station somewhere, and that was about all he did. Okay? David is beginning to put together the trappings of political power. And people kind of liked that and always wanted that to be what would be the new heyday of Jerusalem. Would that a Messiah like David would come along. Nathan, in chapter 7, is a key player. Nathan is a prophet, a successor to Samuel, and now we don't even have different definitions of who Nathan is. Remember with Samuel, he was kind of a seer, he was kind of a judge, and he was a prophet. Now we're into prophets. These are the people who say God's word. And what is interesting is, as the new political leaders are advancing, your Saul, your David, the people who could cut them to the core and whose word they would obey were the prophets. Saul, like it or not, had Samuel. David had Nathan. Both Samuel and Nathan challenged the leader. Solomon, for all of his wisdom, fell apart in part because he had no prophet. You got Saul and Samuel, David and Nathan, Solomon and nobody. But Nathan was the conscience of David, and it is interesting, as God establishes government, government is best when it listens to God's voice through God's people, which is an interesting church-state problem. or an interesting problem for a society that has a church-state division. But that's another story. Which is, by the way, I think I've mentioned in one article in the Maine Press, is a biased terminology. Always biased against Christians, because Christians are the only religion that has a church. It should be religion and government. It should not be church and state. But that's another. I digress. Nathan's message to David, and this is important, is David, you are not going to build the temple. I've survived this long without a temple. You got a lot of stuff to do. You've got international intrigue. You are not the man to build the temple. This is crucial because the building of the temple would really be the pinnacle of the religious life, one would think, of the people. Solomon will do it. You will discover when we get into 1st and 2nd Chronicles that Chronicles were essentially the editors who loved David. And they're going to say that though Solomon put the pieces together, David had done all the work, did all the drawing, got all the lumber, cut all the lumber. Everything was right there, like a little box for Christmas Eve. You can just assemble the stuff and put it together. David did everything, according to Chronicles. Here in Samuel, Nathan is saying to David, no, you're not to do it at all. Then you got military victories. David's just going to beat up on people. You've got the poignant story of Mephibosheth, a relative of Ishbosheth. And you just, you know, if you get mad at those two at once and you really got the adrenaline flowing and you've got to call Ishbosheth and Mephibosheth all at once, people are going to laugh at you because you're going to get that all messed up. Mephibosheth, tragically, a little boy, was dropped in a kind of a hurry-up situation one time, hurt both of his feet, could not walk. David continued to be loyal to Saul's family and took care of Mephibosheth. Now, at the end of chapter 10, you've got really kind of the glory days. I mean, you've got great international relations. You are militarily on top of the world. Nobody, because at this point you don't have the Assyrians or the Egyptians doing much. And, you know, David's he's king of the roost. He has got buildings the likes of which these people have never seen. He's got military conquests the likes of which they've never seen. He's got money, commerce, everything flowing. And this is just, this is the glory days. And as often happens in the glory days, indiscretion takes hold. David always had a character issue problem. God liked David, I suspect, because God likes whoever God decides to like. But also God liked David, not because of David's behavior, but because of the intense emotion of the man. He was a man who would grieve, and would grieve openly. And one of the major things he would grieve that God appreciated is he grieved his own sins. Solomon, the brain, would do something immoral, but would have a rational reason why it was the thing to have done. Saul would do something that Samuel had told him not to do and would say, yes, but I had my reasons for doing it. David, when it was pointed out to him that he had done something wrong, would come unglued in the presence of God. And God, I think, responds well to our coming unglued. One wishes that in addition to his great confession of sin, he had also repented. And we have no reason that David ever quite got around to that step. But nonetheless, here is a man of intense laments for his own sin, and they were legion. The story is this. And I'm going to give you the thing. The names you need to remember up to this point are Jerusalem, Nathan, we'll toll a bell for each name here, Bathsheba, who you're about to meet, and Uriah the Hittite, who was Bathsheba's husband. David, in the palace, goes up on the roof to take a nap. While on the roof, he looks around, and there through the window of the tenement across the avenue, he sees a woman in the bathtub. And it's not unlike, I was on the board of directors of the Y in York, and we got a call of complaint that evidently some of the guys were going up on the roof of the Y and sunning themselves stark naked. Got a call from a woman in York who says, you know, this is absolutely repulsive. You've got these men up on the roof, sunning themselves. They are stark naked. And the guy says, we had not known this. We're troubled by it. We will go up and tell them. She says, this is outrageous. I've been watching them for 40 minutes, and they're just staying there, you know? Well, David was watching Bathsheba take her bath. Now, we will get to know Bathsheba somewhat better when we convene after Christmas on the 6th of January, when we have read 1st and 2nd Kings. Bathsheba was no innocent, naive person. This was one bright individual and somewhat upwardly mobile. She would be the one who would connive to see to it that it was her son who became the next king. Probably in many ways, in terms of political intrigue, a little smarter than David. I wouldn't be altogether surprised if she sees David go up on the roof and says, I think I'll take a bath. You know, I don't know that, but it's not inconceivable. So David says to his friends, go and get the woman out of the bathtub and bring her over here. I'd like to meet with her. Now, this is not your typical photo op in the Oval Office. She comes in to be with David, and before long, David has introduced her to the royal gymnastics, which led to pregnancy. Then she got pregnant. All right? Now this poses a problem for David if she is the wife of Uriah the Hittite, who is a good soldier off fighting a battle, and he can't get her pregnant from the battlefield, and people know that she's just had this visit to the Oval Office. David then scurries about and gets Uriah the Hittite to come home, figuring maybe they'll think on his on brief leave from the front, Uriah the Hittite and his wife Bathsheba, and that caused it. And so Uriah was a good man, and that cost him his life. Uriah comes back, and the thinking of the military in those days is that if you're in battle, your comrades are in battle, you don't engage in sexual activity. It will kind of take the edge off your aggression, I suppose, is what they were thinking. And you also don't do this because it might in some ways make you impure, and it would kind of be an embarrassment and a put down of your buddies who were on the battlefield. And so Uriah the Hittite, who though he has been away with the men for a long period of time, comes back. David says, hey, go see Bathsheba. Uriah refuses. He sleeps outdoors. He'll sleep anywhere, but he won't go and be in the same house with his wife. Amazing. David then figures, I got to get this guy drunk. So he has him over for dinner. They have some Coors Light, and Uriah gets a little tipsy, but still won't go. So David says, I can't get this guy to go to bed with his wife. So he calls Joab, and he says, we're sending Uriah the Hittite back. Put him into the front lines, for the battle is fiercest, and everybody else run away and have the people kill him, which is what happens. Uriah the Hittite, virtuous, good man, is killed, and Bathsheba, without protesting too much, becomes the wife of the king. And so that's chapter 11. Chapter 12 is a famous story where Nathan, now the conscience of the king, comes back and tells that moving story of the poor family that had one lamb. And this poor man loved that lamb as if it were his own child. rich guy up on a hill has all kinds of animals, and he's having some of his rich buddies over for a meal, doesn't want to kill any of his flocks, so he goes and takes the lamb away from the poor man and kills the poor man's lamb. David is incensed. That guy should be beaten up, and we should do terrible things to him. And Nathan has that famous line, "You are the man." Okay? David is devastated. David writes Psalm 51. And it is an explicit response to Nathan having been his conscience. "Be merciful to me, O God, because of your constant love, because of your great mercy. Wipe away my sins, wash away all my evil, and make me clean from my sins. I recognize my faults. I am always conscious of my sins. I have sinned against you, only against you, and done what you consider evil." As this reads in more familiar language in some of the earlier translations. "So you are right in judging me. You are justified in condemning me. I have done evil from the time I was born, from the day of my birth. I've been sinful. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and create a right spirit within me," is a famous phrase from Psalm 51, one of the great gnashings of teeth, the great lament at what a wretched person I am for having done this terrible thing. Symbolic of David's great ability with great emotion to show his confession for sin. The son born of that adulterous affair dies, and the next person born is Solomon. Those two chapters, 11 and 12, and Solomon's reign is going to turn around also with sexual affairs as well. You got this problem that David has had so many children with so many wives and so many concubines. You've got this enormous campus of Brady Bunch type situation here. And some of them begin to fall in love with one another. A fellow decides he likes a sister by some other wife, and he feigns illness. She comes in to feed him. He rapes her. Absalom, who is her brother by whoever that wife, plots and eventually murders this fellow who raped the sister of. It's amazing stuff. And then there's a falling out between Absalom and David. And what is interesting of this one, and Absalom is the other name you need to remember from 2 Samuel, how unbelievably tenuous is David's hold on power. This is King David we're talking about here. This is the guy who killed the giant. This is the guy who intimidated his predecessor Saul. This is the man who brought them to a pinnacle in their history, the likes of which they had never seen. This is the man they would remember in their traditions as the greatest king in the history of Israel. This is the man that they wanted a Messiah to come who would be like David, and it didn't take much to get him in trouble. Absalom begins slowly to turn the people against him. Absalom asks leave to go from Jerusalem to another place. He goes to the other place. He declares he's the king. And the people says, "Yeah, that's all right. It's okay. We'll follow you." Bada boom. Leadership is very tenuous. Very tenuous. It takes very little to undermine it, even for King David. And so David and his entourage have to get out of Jerusalem. Absalom comes in and moves into Jerusalem. So I recollect winds up having relations with various of the concubines. The rumor is that Mephibosheth had been bad-mouthing David, but I don't think he was. Absalom comes is there. Let me see what he says. Absalom and all the Israelites with him entered Jerusalem. I'm in chapter 16, 15. And somebody of an unpronounceable name was with him. And they're all yelling out, long live the king. And then down here, you've got plots and as to what kind of activities to go after. The relations with the concubines. Eventually, what is going to happen, as you probably remember from back in the days of the flannel board, is that Absalom was an unbelievably physically attractive individual with thick hair, which he had to cut once a year, they say, because it was growing so much. Long flowing hair, and was riding along, and as to whether it was his hair that got stuck in a tree or somehow the branches were such that it kind of caught him like this and he was hanging there, and Joab came along and killed him. So Absalom is killed. And you've got that great lament at the end of 18. The king was overcome with grief. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he cried, "Oh, my son Absalom, Absalom, my son, if only I had died in your place, my son Absalom, my son." Okay. Now the Jewish people have a problem. They have seen David cut and run from Jerusalem. He's gone across the Jordan to hide out. They have proven themselves to be fickle in that they have followed Absalom, and Absalom is now dead. And so this poses a quandary for them, where you've got the guy who cut and ran, and you got the guy who's dead. And they reason, of the two of them, the guy who cut and ran is probably going to be better able to lead us than the guy who's dead. So David is going to be our king again, and almost like a bad movie, over here in chapter 19, all of the cast of characters wind up at the Jordan to welcome David back home. Mephibosheth is there. Shimei is there. Now, here's an interesting character. Shimei badmouths David as he's about to flee to get away from Absalom. And now that David is coming back, Shimei feels terrible about this. "Your Majesty, please forget the wrong that I did the day that you left Jerusalem. Don't hold it against me or think of it anymore. I know, sir, that I have sinned, and this is why I am the first one from the northern tribes to come here and meet your majesty today." Ba-da-boom, ba-da-boom, ba-da-boom. And David makes a promise to avoid punishing Shimei. But if you turn over to 1 Kings 2:8, David, in a kind of Marlon Brando, Don Vito Corleone, is making a last breath request to Solomon. There's also Shimei from the town of whatever in Benjamin. "He cursed me bitterly the day I went to whatever town is pronounced. But when he met me at the Jordan River, I gave him my solemn promise in the name of the Lord that I would not have him killed. But you must not let him go unpunished." You know what to do. You must see to it that he's put to death. David, the great, you know, the Lord is my shepherd guy, as his last earthly requests, putting contracts out on his enemies. All right? Amazing stuff. Now, he comes back, and Solomon took care of all those contracts. When David comes back, you've again got this battle between Judah and the northern kingdoms. The split, the rift is there. The kingdom is ready to divide. In the next books you read, it's going to divide. David, as best he could, tried to hold it together. So here you've got a fellow named Sheba, son of Bichri, tribe of Benjamin, blew the trumpet. "Down with David," he says, "not going to follow him. Men of Israel, let's go home." So the Israelites deserted David and went to Sheba. But the men of Judah stayed loyal, and they get all that put back together again. It's always having to deal with a people that are on the verge of division. You have got David singing a song, taking a census, and being punished for that. The thought is that the plague that was the punishment for having taken a census, and the idea was if you really trust God, maybe you don't need to take a census. but there was a plague following it. In all probability, the census takers were carrying germs, and they took them out to the outer precincts. 2 Samuel is an unbelievably seamy book. The nation, fundamentally divided, terribly fickle, the greatest king in the history of the people has a very tenuous hold on power. He is a murderous, adulterous individual. And God somehow is working through these people in this place to work his purpose out. And people say, well, explain to me exactly how that happens. If I could, I would. You know, this is a mystery. There's mysterious stuff as to how God gets his work done on this earth through the cast of characters that we present God to deal with. And it's not wholly unlike some of what God must see when he looks at the church. So, at any rate, we will take that up when we come back in the new year. It's the last class of the year, students. And when you get back from Florida, all tanned and rested, we will gather on the first Monday of the new year, and we will look at the two kings, names to recognize if you've never read this before. Solomon, obviously, Elisha and Elijah, two different people, and you'd never want to preach on the two of them because the congregation will never know which one you're referring to. Elisha and Elijah, you're going to have Ahab and Jezebel, but if you can remember Solomon and Elijah, then you will be you'll be ready. Elijah, a great prophet. See you then. Have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and what have you.